stop before you all sit down there. Please sit down.
David Gilmour, guitariste et chef de Pink Floyd, avec Rick Wright, organiste, Roger Water, bassiste, et Nick Mason, batteur.
If I can remember what it was that we were going to play next, I'd tell you, but I can't. So
welcome to episode one of our new podcast called Fingal's Cave. My name is Nils Tinfenik, and I got with me Ian Priston. I'm very happy and very proud that you joined me on that podcast. And I call myself one of the biggest Pink Floyd fans, and I consider myself knowing more about Pink Floyd than 99% of the population, but you're a whole different kind. I would say you're something like top 10 of Pink Floyd. So
very kind.
So in comparison, I would say that I'm a huge fan and observer, but I would call you more like a researcher, archivist.
Yeah, I would say researcher and archivist, and basically somebody who tries to get to the bottom of various Pink Floyd mysteries. And I've been now concentrating on doing that for 25 years. So it's been quite a journey over that time.
So we met at a Pink Floyd community in 2006.
Indeed.
I couldn't say meet because you were one of the guardians and one of the people I looked up to, because I was just, when the community started, I was there. I was collecting bootlegs by the time, being a big Pink Floyd bootleg collector, and the whole community just opened up, as I said, a Pandora's box, just with so many different kind of recordings, many, many more than I ever would have thought of, much better quality. And as I know now, you're somehow involved in that.
Yes, it's been quite a busy time, hasn't it, over a very long period. And you're talking about communities and guardians and things like that. It makes it sound a little bit like a cult, doesn't it? It's not a cult, folks. It's a nice place, and Pink Floyd fans have a lot in common, we tend to find. We're all interested in the music deeply, as you might appreciate from the nature of this podcast and the conversation that we're having today. We're also all quite friendly as well, and we spend a lot of time chatting to one another, and it's a good thing to be part of. And I think we've achieved quite a lot over the decades it is now, haven't we?
So, first question of this podcast, why Pink Floyd? Why? What makes Pink Floyd so special?
I think once you've been gripped by Pink Floyd, it gets you at quite a deep level. And you need to listen to the right Pink Floyd for that experience. I'm quite biased on this. And if you go listening to Pink Floyd in their releases in 1987, and that's the first thing you listen to, I don't think you're going to get the experience that we enjoy. You probably also wouldn't get the experience if you listen to Another Brick in the Wall, the single, or The Wall, the album. You need to go looking further back in time, and that's where my journey started. As a youngster, I'd be sat in my front room with my mum. Big brother John was in the room next door. John and I shared a room, and he owned most of that room because he was 6 or 7 years older than me, depending on the time of the year. And he was a big Pink Floyd fan, amongst various other things. And he was always gripped by his music, and remains to this day the person I turn to if I need to know the answer to who was playing a certain chord in a German krautrock band from 1970. John will no doubt know that because he's the expert. So John back in the day was very fond of metal, and he liked playing Echoes, and he particularly liked the funky section of Echoes, that bit in the middle where Roger
Reasonable.
gets really into leading his band, as it was at the time. And he had big speakers and they would make the walls shake, and Mum and I would sit there and sometimes get a bit grumpy about it. But then after a while, I began to realise as a teenager that I rather liked him. And then I would go and look at his record collection when he was out at whatever concert he was out at that night, Lucky Man, in the 1980s, because there were some great bands around then. And I would come across albums like Animals and look at that pig flying in the sky above Battersea Power Station and start thinking, this band is interesting. And then I would get Atom Heart Mother out and I'd think, what about that cow? And it kind of gets to grip you. If you don't get this, I don't think you ought to be listening to this podcast, because you're probably not on a similar wavelength to us, but it's something that gripped me then and has got me gripped at quite a deep level for many years hence. And it's what drives the passion for me and drives the researching and the hours that I put into Pink Floyd basically every day of the week.
Yeah, but Atom Heart Mother was also the first album that touched me, so to speak. We had a few records at home when I was 4 or 5 years old. We had The Dark Side of the Moon and Atom Heart Mother and Animals, I guess, later on. But it was Atom Heart Mother, and I remember playing it. I was scared to death because in my being 4 or 5 years old, in my head there was the story of a guy stealing some diamonds, robbing a store and fleeing away from the scene with a motor bicycle.
Of course, yeah.
And then the police on horses.
Yeah, that's definitely
going behind him. That's
a Wild West
that was
scene there.
Exactly,
isn't there?
That was my. And then I remember that Dark Side of the Moon. I loved the intro from Money, and when I picked the wrong side, which is the right side, like side A, it was Speak to Me, of course, and there were some effects, but I remember being a small child being totally disappointed that's the wrong side, because I wanted to listen to Money, and there was some Money effect in there, but just very low. And then I got lost, or Pink Floyd got lost in my mind for a few years, and when I was like 11 or 12, I listened to Atom Heart Mother again, and I cried. I literally cried because the experience I had being a small child, it was so intense, and I put it all together as living there with my parents, and from that moment on I started collecting bootlegs, and it's
there's quite a lot of nostalgia, isn't there, with Pink Floyd. I think we associate them with various crucial points in our lives, and we all do that. It might be the breakup of a relationship. It might be the first album we bought. Those sorts of images that we have in our minds of listening to those records as people our age did back in the day, and appreciating the music for the first time. And it just hits you and can grip you. And I guess that's what this podcast series is going to explore, is some of those journeys that we've been on, some of the things that other people have experienced as they've got to know and love the band, and some of the fascinating, sometimes funny, sometimes amusing, sometimes downright weird things people get up to as collectors and listeners of Pink Floyd concert recordings. It's not been explored much, has it? So hopefully we're going to break some new ground with this, and there are some really good stories to be told, and these stories are quite precious. As I say, they've not been written down before particularly, and the people who can tell these stories and have these memories are now often, because these things were happening in the 60s and 70s, some of the things that we'll be talking about, they are in their 60s and 70s now. They are of a certain age, and it's becoming crucial to capture their memories and to get down their recordings, get down their experiences before, frankly, it becomes too late.
Yes. It's just thinking of a book only about these stories. I mean, every single time I do a little research by myself and I'm just browsing through the different websites explaining anything about a concert or just giving a behind story, I just want to listen to it later on. Then, because it's just like a documentary. It's unbelievable.
And books are something as well. I think we ought to talk about some of the things that books can bring to the table. If you're watching this right now, you'd see that I've got one on my lap, which is our book that we published last summer, Phil and I, a book about Pink Floyd's BBC radio recordings between 1967 and 1971 in the UK on the BBC. I was also a co-author of another book, Pink Floyd, an Embryo, a Chronology, from 1967 to 1971, around the turn of the century rather. That book was co-authored with Nick Hodges. And books are a great way to find out more about a band. Obviously reading them and consuming them is a good way, and there are some excellent ones out there which we could perhaps talk a bit about and what you might learn from them. But I'm thinking more about specifically the act of writing a book or publishing a book, as I'm saying this, because that to me has really opened doors over the years. To give you an example, when Nick and I wrote our first book and that was published, that brought all sorts of people out of the woodwork, which we felt really fortunate with. So UK tapers came forward and said, great to see what you've done. By the way, I was the taper of that particular gig at Manchester University in 1969, and this is what happened to it next, and this is why you're never going to find it, because unfortunately it was lost over the years. It also brought other people out of the woodwork. For me, hugely memorably, it brought out of the woodwork a guy in New York who picked up the book and wrote us a lovely letter saying how much he'd enjoyed it. He wondered what we had in terms of the film from Bath 1970. And anybody who's listening to this will know that there's quite a well-known recording of Atom Heart Mother from that concert, which was first on various unofficial releases and then made it into Pink Floyd's early years box set in 2016. So this chap told me a story of how he knew that a chap had taken in a huge reel of film into a New York video store in the 1980s, and on that film there was a nice label on the front that said Pink Floyd Bath 1970. And he wondered what it was. I think we can see what it might turn out to be. And that store then helped him transfer it to VHS back in the time. He wondered whether that might be of any use to Nick and I. And obviously, after we picked our jaws up off the floor, we said, yes, please. And we got to see that film. And it was delightful to see that the whole concert still exists. And it's a pretty wacky concert. If you were to see it, there is at one point a naked man dancing on the stage in front of Pink Floyd and greatly distracting them. Some of us wish he wasn't there, because it's the sort of memory that you can't quite forget.
Yes.
There was a naked man, I must mention, and some people know this, but there was a naked man who often invaded the stage at Pink Floyd's concerts, right the way up to Nebworth 1975. Don't know who this man was, but he had a nickname, and perhaps we'll return to that in one of the later episodes. I was hearing the story of that the other week from a good friend of mine.
So we are at London right now.
We are.
And for me, coming from Germany, a small town in Germany, where nothing just happening. Of course, there were no concerts at all, anything. But when I took the tube and the Piccadilly line, I mean, every single station where you can find the location Pink Floyd played live. And we were at a trade fair today. We visited a trade fair, and I mean, there was one seller who just told you out of nothing about a Pink Floyd. He thought it would be 71, but you corrected him, of course.
Yes.
Because you realized that it must be 72, and then he he even mentioned the flashlights in the beginning, and yeah. it's so unbelievable that being here in London, I would say meeting anybody being at least 60 or 65 years old, I guess must have seen a Pink Floyd concert.
You've got a good chance, haven't you? So that's one of my research methods, is men in their 60s who still got long hair are quite likely to have a story to tell at least. They might also have something in their loft.
Yes.
So I seek them out. And I'm about the wrong age for that. I kind of need to be younger, and then they would be my grandparents. Or I need to be a bit older, and you know, they'd be my peers. So I'm slightly the wrong age, but I would say that's good advice for researchers, is to try and seek out people who might have those stories. And he was funny, wasn't he? I mean, he'd just come out of the army, that chap, and he'd knew that he'd seen Pink Floyd in Southampton, and he knew it was The Dark Side of the Moon, but swore blind it was 1971.
And he was grateful that you corrected him, because he was in the beginning, he was quite positive. No, 71. And then you said, it might be Dark Side of the Moon. Yeah, it was Dark Side of the Moon. Oh, yeah, thank you very much. He came back again. And
he's probably told that story 100 times. Yes. Now he knows the correct year, doesn't he? But it's amazing how people misremember things. But often in those misrememberings are sort of germs and facts of truth. And I mean, this is what we found with both of the books, is going to people and asking them for their recollections can really lead you places. My advice to anybody who, and this may seem a little bit flippant, but my advice to anybody who really wants to get in depth with Pink Floyd is write a book, or announce that you're writing a book. And in order to announce that you're writing a book, you do need to have a publisher. So when you go to, as we did, the BBC archives for this research, the BBC needed to know that we had a publisher, and we needed a letter from a publisher to demonstrate it. So it's not one of those things you can pretend or fake, because institutions are likely to want to ring your referee and check that you have those things. But it opens doors. And people who were there at the time are always, nearly invariably, honoured, keen, amused to be part of a book and to have that idea. And so when we wrote about the BBC, we didn't get any resistance whatsoever. Everybody we said, well, it's likely to go into a book. Is that okay with you? Absolutely fine, they said. And what they wanted to do then was to refine what they said and to make sure it was as accurate as possible. And then we get those records down. We get those stories. We're like historians. We're kind of like going into Tutankhamun's, you know.
So if I'm not able to write a book, what could be my methods to research? What could be... Okay. What could I do with the actual systems or social media?
Yeah, that's powerful as well. And there's a whole new group of younger researchers, which feels really heartening to me as somebody who's getting on a bit, who are now actively digging around. So they are at the right age to ask older members of the family, but they are going instead to places like social media for their research. So tips for anybody who's doing this: keep a close eye on Facebook, keep an eye on what Pink Floyd are posting, and look out for people who then reply, I was at that concert, and jump on them nicely, gently, politely, ask them for their recollection. And then once you've asked them for their recollection, ask them if they got any photographs. Did they take any pictures? They know anybody who did. And then you'll be amazed at how many people are quite happy and quite fascinated to follow up that little post they did that day with a little bit of research for you, and they'll help you out. So Facebook is powerful for that. YouTube is also very powerful because there's all sorts of random stuff that goes up on there, and people's comments that go with it can be really insightful as well. So a lot of digging there goes on, and it can be very productive. Trouble with YouTube, of course, is that you can't personal message somebody at YouTube. There's none of the directness there, and you have to post in the thread so everybody knows what you're up to. So that's a bit of a shame, because you lose the sort of privacy of that, and then the person might be a little bit less willing to reply to you. But still worth a shot. And there are some fascinating discoveries that have come up on YouTube in more recent years, continue to. So I would say that's really quite a vital resource as well.
So starting in 2006, I was collecting bootlegs until that time, but then I realized, okay, the bootlegs most often are of worse quality, of course, than what is out there. But there were massive changes in quality between 2006 and now. I mean, there are so many wonderful remasters and new recorders being found, and better generations or even masters being found. So we got quite a lot covered, I would say. But what do you think? How many different recordings are still out there not being unearthed already?
Well, the ones that I know of that aren't doing the rounds, I'd probably say there's about 20% that aren't doing the rounds at the moment. The early years are quite well represented in those recordings. There's not a lot missing from 1967. The band has recordings from 1967 of concerts, regrettably, I understand, which may not see the light of day. There's several recordings from 1968 that are still around and have yet to surface. The Netherlands springs to mind, Italy springs to mind, and London does as well. And there's a number of fascinating recordings from 69. So yeah, there's plenty out there, and they are often from those what I would describe most interesting years. I mean, if you can wind all the way forward to the Wall shows in 1980 and 1981, that's virtually entirely covered, isn't it? But I think it would be possible to fill in the remaining gaps.
There are still some radio stations, as I remember, some radio stations who should have recordings.
Oh, indeed, they do.
In their archives.
And people make it their business to try and track those down as well.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit in the back of our book as a section of what we know is out there. And it would be wonderful, of course, to see all of those things given a decent official release at some point in the future. And one of the things that obviously affects that is copyright. That can be quite an interesting area, and it's become quite a grey area, of course, in recent years, because when you and I obviously were at that record fair in London, Victoria earlier today, every Pink Floyd section had lots of bootleg records in it, didn't it?
Yeah.
Shiny new records, £40.
Seems to be a raising market already.
It is. And people are passionate about it. There are forums dedicated to it, and people love it. And it shows that there is the appetite out there. But I guess what we're talking about in this series more is about the recordings that you needn't pay for, because if you go looking on the internet for them, on YouTube or on various forums and so on, there are people who are gladly tracking down, restoring and sharing these recordings for nothing, which are then sadly in some ways picked up by people who make a profit out of them and sell them.
So I, as being a member of the community and a big Pink Floyd fan, I do get the final, whatever got revealed, I get the final result, and I'm very happy. And how do you feel being much more involved in the endeavor of the research, maybe remastering and whatever? How do you feel about the stuff you know that exists but you can't put your hands on? Are you angry about it?
Or? Oh, no, I'm equally happy with those items as well. You learn to be philosophical, because if I spend time every day on this, I must encounter all sorts of dead ends, and I have over the years. And I know where certain things are in certain collections, and I know that people have really good reasons to not pass them on. And they're really sincere reasons. And as long as you respect people and are decent and kind to people, they will be back. And one of my beefs over the years is with how some people don't feel terribly able to do that for whatever reason. And there does seem a sort of an internet culture of entitlement sometimes, and abrasiveness, and that may be a very small number of people, but those who are spending the time doing that first-hand research, putting the hours in, doing the travelling and so on, find that quite grating, and that is a problem. It's an issue. So we kind of need to spread the load. We all need to get a bit kinder to one another, and make sure that everybody who's putting in the effort is, you know, properly appreciated. That doesn't mean money. It might mean a thank you. It might mean a idea for a next thing that can be pursued. But it's something that is a little bit like a labour of love. It's like tending, you know, your favourite garden or something like that, and you gladly do it. And I find that fascinating and compelling, and I can't see it ever stopping. Most people I know don't really get it, but fortunately there are quite a lot of people I know who do, and that has been for me the most marvellous thing over the years. So, you know, writing this book with Phil, I met him through a Pink Floyd forum. Phil is tremendously knowledgeable about music. He's a lecturer in music at State University of New York. He welcomed me to his home in New York in 2019, and we had the most wonderful 10 days exploring, talking about Pink Floyd, dreaming up the idea of this book. So Pink Floyd and fascination, research, scholarly work with it can really take you places. And, you know, our conversation we're having today wouldn't happen if it weren't for some of those forums that exist. And I'm glad to say, and can say this quite genuinely, that I feel like I could go and visit a whole series of people around Europe and America who would gladly welcome me and have a beer with me and talk about Pink Floyd. And I think that's rather a nice thing. And forums, studying, websites and so on have really opened that up to a lot of us.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's the same for me. It always caught me that in my private life, so to speak, it's quite difficult to explain that to anybody outside this bubble, so to speak, because they, of course, just don't get it. I always dreamt, I even had the idea of putting an ad in the newspaper of Pink Floyd superfan who wants to meet another Pink Floyd superfan, because I always wanted to talk with anybody about any specific concert, what I felt about it, how I realized it, how I got it, or whatever. And it's being in Germany, where I live, it's almost impossible. So it's that's also a part of this podcast for me personally, to be able to talk with you about very specific things, about different recordings, about the stories behind the tapes. The story, the technical side of it could be, or will be, would be a very interesting to have in another episode. And that's just something extraordinary for me, that it's not just the music or just Pink Floyd or even only the studio albums, but every single concert tells a story of the taper. If it's a taper who got somehow caught, or I had to ask a girlfriend or a friend of his to record the show, or a taper who got taken off his machines, and another taper taping it. There are so many wonderful stories out there.
Oh, yeah. There's failed machines. There's failed recordings. There's girlfriends going into concerts. Yeah. Appearing heavily pregnant, and then when they open their Afghan coat, they've got a dirty, great big reel-to-reel recorder underneath it, which they promptly give birth to and plug into the mains to make a recording. There are people who tucked microphones behind their ears, in their hats, in various places on their person, just to get them through security. There were people who had to dodge security in the UK at times where there was very heightened security due to terrorist risks, and they still got through, and the band inspired them to do that. So there we have it. We have a very inventive band, creative band, and fans to match.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to mention. I think the even in the early 70s, even prior to Dark Side, the Eclipse Suite they played in 72, I think everybody knew, if I go to a Pink Floyd concert, it's not just the music, it's some sort of event, it's futuristic. I have to do the best to record that. And that might be the reason why we have so many different wonderful recordings.
There'll be sound effects, there'll be bubbles, there'll be birds.
Quad sound. I mean, it's...
There'll be a Caliban-type creature from the Tempest walking around the audience. There might be a naked man on the stage in Bath 1970, and various other concerts in between.
Technical failures due to the power loss.
There were those.
I mean, Pepperland is most famous. I just love to listen to all the different.
Yeah, let's have another try.
Yeah.
Where's the vocals gone? You get that. Sorry, we're so late. The journey was bad. You know, don't forget to pick up your litter as you go, please, because it's cool to do that. I felt very 2023 when you hear that in Amsterdam on the 26th of June 1971. The DJ at the end saying tidy up after yourselves. I mean, all these little details come out in these recordings because people just had the foresight to think this is an event and I want to capture it. And these things still exist to this day. Many of them are now digitized. Many of them are available via forums, via YouTube and the like. Some are not yet. Some of them are in the process of being saved for the future. And that's one of the things that fascinates us, isn't it? And I think we ought to do some exploring around how that works technically and then how you get there. So I think that's often about friendships, persistence, kindness, and being inquiring, and perhaps being inventive, just like those tapers were in the first place, and asking the right people the right questions.
So yeah, absolutely. So speaking of tension, maybe even tension within the community, do you think it might be a mirror or reflect somehow from the tension of the band itself? I mean, there are so very different streams within the band, at least after 73, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the Roger Waters community, so to speak. We have the David Gilmour crew.
Mm-hmm. And there was obviously a lot of push and pull that went on in the band and a lot of alienation for the likes of...
Nick Mason being in the middle for a long time, Rick Wright somehow being the outsider for whatever reason.
Yeah, but surely the most talented musician
is
the one I always choose to follow. You know, he's the man with the azimuth coordinator sending it around 15th of June 1971 in... Abbey de Royaumont, seeing him doing that in the church and seeing the sound. You can't hear it, obviously, because it's mono, but, you know, just a sense of the what the control that he had and the musicianship and the different instruments that he was skilled to play.
But still in 2006, David Gilmour, in the documentary on his tour, mocked him in front of camera, being too cocky about his voice and should calm down a little. So
he had a lovely voice, didn't he? When you hear the two of them singing together at Pompeii in 71, I mean, it's all the better for it, isn't it?
Yes.
But Pompeii, I mean, gosh, that's another thing, isn't it? All those different versions of Pompeii. But we don't really hear about all the different versions, do we?
Yeah, that's true. But already...
Quad, mono, stereo. Best stereo, 1986. UK VHS, why? Random, but it's true. Got to change the speed on that one, though, because VHS tapes, when they're official, always played at the wrong speed.
Yes, of course, 25 frames.
Yeah.
Speed up, no problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It worked perfectly, didn't it?
So talking about the tension, do you think that this tension created creativity within the band, or do you think it somehow disturbed or... took the chance to be even more creative and better?
It's really hard to say, isn't it? Because we weren't on the inside. Tension is an important part of the band's offering, isn't it? I mean, if you think of animals, I think of anger. And I think of animals, the 2018 remix, and I think that anger was stripped out. and it was softened. It was made to sound like Wish You Were Here or Dark Side of the Moon, wasn't it?
Mm.
Whereas, as we know, there were the recordings that preceded the release of Animals. I'm thinking of the ones that do the rounds, the tape that got out. And I'm thinking of the live performances of You Gotta Be Crazy, Raving and Drooling. And you can see there's a lot of anger there, isn't there? And it was always bubbling beneath the surface, and these were really driven men, so, in particular. Roger
so after
Waters,
the anger
course.
From 77, there was frustration in 80 with the war?
I think they just became a bit complacent, didn't they, after that point? And it became the Roger Waters show. And then you lose me, I'm afraid. I want to go back to 67 now. Can we talk about 67? But 67's not your thing, is it?
No, not 67. I mean, everything behind
67
after
is fascinating.
Yeah, maybe,
I mean,
maybe.
I can think of the things that are out there for 67. I mean, there's a whole load of studio recordings for 67 that haven't reached the light of day yet. And that just feels a bit wrong to me. I hope they do at some point. There's hours of it. And 68, I mean... recently I put up on my wall in my studio at home my original poster of The Committee. Do you like that music that goes with The Committee?
I'm not there, no.
You're not that struck? Oh,
oh
God,
I'm sorry,
yeah. You're
losing
me there. Well,
podcaster.
The Committee music, that's something I'd like to unearth as well. And it's something that I've been on a little bit of an on-off journey with over the years, and I think we might get there with that at some point. 69 then. Have I got you on 69?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
67 or 68 already.
69, yeah. There's plenty out there as well. And I know a fellow with a very interesting live reel-to-reel.
Yeah, after that,
I'd like to see reach the light of day.
After that, I couldn't even pick a year up to 77. I like every year, maybe not 73, because I think it's... Maybe it's due to the fact that there are not too many good recordings from 33 out there, but... 73, sorry. Mm. But it's not... Somehow it's not my year, but 72 I love a lot, and even 74, 75. And 77 is... So strange, because what changed in 72 from the very early Eclipse Suite in January up to almost completion in December 72, I think the same happened the other way around 77. They started quite nicely in Germany, I guess, and then going to England, France, and then in the US it all went down, and with the most infamous ending show in Montreal, where it all fell apart.
Yeah,
literally fell apart. I mean, Roger Waters was crying at Wish You Were Here, not whining, but just singing like very aggressive and not being.
But it's fascinating, isn't it?
Fascinating.
But I like the sound effects as well. So one of the things that fascinates me is quad sound now. So I'm gradually building a system to appreciate it better at home, and there's one or two particular exponents of quad who are doing some really interesting work on restoring old recordings, and some of those are just compelling to hear the sound move from side to side, round and round, backwards and forwards. It must have been quite something for those audiences. And when you hear somebody saying, wow, when they hear the footsteps in Cymbeline, you can see why they might have felt that, because they could feel that going around.
Nobody
that
did that
at
that time.
No, they didn't. Nobody. They were groundbreaking.
And that, together with On the Run live, must have been mind-blowing.
It must
for
have
example,
been.
The technical sort of music. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
This.
So these single recordings that we have don't tend to capture that. So if you go back thinking of the early days, you don't get stereo recordings very often at all. They start becoming more commonplace in 71. 72, they're really picking up. And so there's a really good date that I'd like to draw your attention to that's likely to start doing the rounds soon, which is the Hollywood Bowl from 22nd of September 1972, where there are multiple recorders, including two rather good stereo ones. Multiple, six to be exact, six tapers that night, who were all in various positions, mostly in the middle of the auditorium, but were spread out well enough to capture it, you know, some towards the back, a little bit towards the front and to the sides and so on. And Pink Floyd did a particularly interesting formation with their quad set up that night. It was somewhat unique. They also pushed the sound system to the limit. So there are parts where you think it might be the tape player's fault that it's sounding a little bit overloaded, but I'm afraid it's actually the PA that's overloaded. So they were really in the mood and going for it. And these six tapers combined can quite easily, well, quite easily, after about 45, I think it is, iterations so far, produce you the most marvellous sounding concert experience of that night. And it starts with a drug deal and chatter about what's going to be going on, and it takes you through The Dark Side of the Moon, an early version, most wonderful rendition of Careful That Axe, Eugene, and a long time after that you're finally through and you've heard the entire thing.
You're exhausted.
And you are.
How would John Peel call it? A tour de force.
He would, perhaps, yeah, very nicely thought of. Yeah, I agree with you on that. So it's like those experiences that kind of drive us with this hobby, this pastime, this passion, to try and see whether we can really bottom out what was going on those occasions. Pink Floyd themselves are much less interested in these things nowadays. They were perfectionists at the time. And I guess we're still in that space. We're still trying to look for what they were trying to do. We're still trying to recreate and pinpoint that expertise, that passion that they created on the stage, those moods that they took us all through. And it's there in those recordings. It still exists despite the limitations of the technology. It's so, not the age of the iPhone. It was the age of the big reel-to-reel deck.
Uha Mono cassette recorder.
Yeah, yes. That's it. See, you're doing it with a German accent. I'd call it a Ua.
A Uha.
That's much better, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there was a mono one, and then they got to a stereo one. But the mono one was fine. Mono was recorded, used to record Bath 1970. And I think that reel still exists, by the way.
Wow.
That'd be nice to get that, because it always sounds a little bit distorted. And that's one of the beauties of modern technology, is that sometimes you can take some of that distortion out. I'm not interested, by the way, for those who kind of dwell on these things, in ideas about putting in vocals where they weren't there, or stereoizing mono recordings. Not too keen on all of that. If it was mono, let it be mono. But if there were two mono recordings and one was at the front and one was at the back, definitely put those together.
Perfect.
Because then you get panning.
So wrapping it up for today, there are two things
mm-hmm.
I would like to say. First thing, please don't give up in researching and trying your best to create the best out of whatever is available there.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing, don't get frustrated by Pink Floyd itself.
No, I will try not to. We've got a lot of work to do ahead, and there's a lot of fascinating breakthroughs that can be made. And it'd be nice to talk about some of that journey in a bit more detail. And hopefully, as we do that, we might bring some other stories out of the woodwork, because it'd be good to think that there'll be some listeners who might say, oh, I was there.
I have something to contribute.
Actually, in my loft...
Yes,
I've got a recording of Pink Floyd from Radio One Club in 1968, and I captured the entire thing. I would like that, please.
It might
that
be the Holy Grail and nobody knows about.
Yeah, something along those lines, or whatever it might be. All of it is interesting and compelling to us fans and us devotees, and it would be lovely if we can make the best of this journey.
Thank you very much. This would have been episode one. Mm-hmm. I hope there are many more to come. Maybe we even will have some guests at a time.
Yeah, Let's do
for
that.
Sure, we have many more stories, many mm-hmm. more things to reveal, and if we somehow manage to create even a bigger lust for Pink Floyd,
mm-hmm. All the
would
better.
Be lovely, all the better. So I thank you very much, and I thank all of you for listening, maybe even watching.
Yeah. Nice to meet you all.
Have a good
See
night.
See you again soon.
Or have a good day whenever you're listening to it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.